Well, years ago, there was a book that came out that said, real men don't eat quiche. I think it also said in that book that real men don't use deodorant. Real men don't use or buy flight insurance. Real men don't play frisbee, and real men don't wear pink. For what it's worth. So Chad has some real men things here, too. Real men drink real coffee. And therefore, real men don't drink Folgers. And real men don't order hot chocolate with whip at a coffee shop. Real men don't drink coffee, real coffee, from styrofoam cups. Why would you do that? Real men don't add cream and sugar to their coffee. Real men don't drive Fords. And I know I'm going to offend some here, but nonetheless, because I'm brazen and often lacking in common sense, real men do not listen to country western music. So, now that I've offended pretty much most of you in some way or another here, I just want to go forward here. There's a bumper sticker that's been out for years. It says, real men love Jesus. Jesus is worth loving. Jesus was a real man, and he raised the bar for all of us. Not only does it take a real man to say that he loves Jesus, but it takes a real man to obey his commandments, to imitate his character, and to follow his example. Bumper sticker religion is not very pleasing to God, and it certainly won't save your soul. So while the bumper sticker may profess something that is noble and virtuous in itself, it takes real men to carry that out. And I want you to think about that as we go forward here. A man of God is not just an adult male who happens to be in a church building during service. He is a follower of Jesus. He is imitating, learning, adopting, and adapting that which his master has taught him. That's a real man. And when a man seeks God's direction genuinely and sincerely, God listens to that man and directs him to his word. And that man, if he applies himself, becomes a man of God. Not because the Bible makes him so, but because the Bible teaches him how to be so, and he listens to that. When a real man does not shrug and resign, saying something like, well, I'm only human, that's what our world says, or that's just the way I am, that's what worldly men say, or giving up or settling for low standards, that's what, again, our generation has done. He strives for perfection of character. He seeks things that are above. He lives on a higher plane. He is a pillar and a beacon in his family, in his congregation, and in his community. That's a real man. And yet, he defers all glory and honor and praise to the one who has taught him, Jesus Christ. He's not afraid to say the name, and he's not afraid to say who he serves. Just think about that. This is what's sorely lacking in our society today, is the conviction to say who we really love and to stand by that conviction with our actions. None of this happens automatically. None of it happens by accident. It is a series of decisions that begins with one's commitment in baptism and then extends through the rest of that man's life. So it's something you've got to work on. In fact, you've got to work on it daily. Even Jesus said this in essence in Luke 9:23. If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. It's a daily decision. It's not something you did 20 years ago or 10 years ago in your baptism, and then you kind of, faltered in that and wandered away from that. It's something that you strive to do every day. And when you fall down, you get back up. And when you find yourself drifting, you get back on course. And even when you're doing very well, you do what it takes to stay doing very well. That's what real men do. And if anyone wishes to be a man of God, he has to do the same thing. And he has to inspire others to follow him. Last week, we saw what a man of God is not. If you missed that lesson, if you're visiting with us, we do have the printouts, at least of the handout there in the foyer. You're welcome to that. This week, we want to look at what a real man of God does look like and why that's so valuable to us and in our honor of God. I should start out by saying, and you should know this, that physical size, physical strength, physical ability has nothing to do with being a man of God. Samson was one of the strongest men that we know of in the Bible, and yet he was defeated by a weak character. I want you to think about that for a moment. He was defeated by a weak character. And we have, in recent history with the Seahawks and perhaps other sports teams as well, we see these star athletes paid millions of dollars to do what they do, play football, and yet even though they have all kinds of ability and strength and endurance and so on, sometimes they just can't keep their mouth shut, or sometimes they can't calm their temper, and those little things like that are character flaws, and those character flaws lead to their ejection from the team and really the ruining of what could have been a very great career. So here's a man with great strength and prowess and manliness, as you might say, in the athlete world, but no character, or lacking in character. King Saul was head and shoulders above the rest. He was big, he was strong, he was handsome, and yes, he was a king. And he was also a dismal failure due to character issues, because he was too much like Israel, impatient, self-centered, caving to peer pressure, unfocused allegiance. He was too much a reflection of the people that he tried to lead. And thus, size and strength and status don't help by themselves if a man has a bad heart. And bad hearts produce bad fruit. And so that's why we're seeing bad fruit coming from some men in our society, and even in the church, sadly, sometimes. We see bad fruit because the heart is corrupted. Good trees, however, produce good fruit, and a man of God is one who allows God to temper his heart and transform his heart so it is a good heart, and then it will necessarily bear good fruit. David was a man after God's own heart, it says in Scripture. He was not perfect, we all know that, and he suffered dearly for his sins. But ultimately, he yielded to God. In fact, there's a great passage, I won't take time to read it, but I invite you to read that, where he's saying to Solomon on his own deathbed, on David's deathbed, he says to his son Solomon, show yourself to be a man. And then he told him how, in essence. It's not through physical strength, but rather through the strength, first of all, of character. He doesn't say all these words, but it's implied in what he's telling him in. Strength of character. What type of man are you? What quality of man are you? What nature of man are you? Even when no one is looking. I think it was Abraham Lincoln that said that one time. The character is what you're really like when no one is looking. And that says a lot. You know, what do you do when no one's looking? What kind of person are you when no one's around to keep you in line or to hold you, to some kind of responsibility? Also, conscience is involved in that. What a man thinks about, what he approves of. He loves what God loves. He hates what God hates. That would be a man of God. Not all men do that, however. What about purpose? What do you intend to do? What do you plan to do? Does your life have purpose? Is your present and your future resting in God and his ability to perform, or is it in something less, like your own or someone else's ability to perform? And of course, there is commitment, convictions that are needed to carry out an intent and that plan that we talked about. Here's a man who's acting, demonstrating that which he professes to believe. So he doesn't just say, I love Jesus. He acts it out. He demonstrates it. He exhibits this with his character, with his behavior. Okay? A lot of the stuff I'm going to go through here this morning, by the way, is pretty nuts and bolts, basic stuff. There is no rocket science going on here, okay, because I'm not a rocket scientist, all right? That would be the first thing. And pretty much this is just fundamental life prescriptions like we talked about in class this morning. So don't think this is too hard. And in fact, most of it's just going to be reminder of stuff you probably already know intuitively. But nonetheless, it is extremely important. Just as David trusted in the Lord to defeat Goliath instead of himself or the king's armor or even the army of Israel, so men of God have to trust in Jesus Christ to overcome the world and to walk the narrow way and face their enemies and the daunting challenges that we today have as men. And there are many. So think about that David chose to trust in God above all, and that trust did not fail him. And if you trust in Jesus Christ and place all your confidence in Jesus' ability to lead you, guide you, train you, transform you, you are not going to be disappointed in that. Nobody gets to heaven and then says, well, I regret all the time I invested in getting here in the first place, right? Nobody does that. Joshua also was a man of God, but only because he listened to God and trusted in God. And you, men, can become the same thing for the same reason or by the same method, by listening to God and trusting in God. Three times in the passage that we had, Joshua 1, verse 1 through 9, Three times God says, be strong and courageous. God gave him a reason to be strong and a reason to be courageous. He didn't just say, you go out there and be strong and I'm going to wait in the wings hoping that you do well. You know, some people think God is like a cheerleader. You know, the team's out there struggling and fighting and trying to survive, and God's, you know, with pom-poms on the side. You can do it. You can do it. It's not how it is. God is right there in the thick of it. God is right there leading us into battle. God is right there fighting, not just with us, but for us. God is right there. Be strong, therefore, and be courageous. Have I not sent you? Am I not with you? Is really what he says in that passage. John 16, verse 33, doesn't Jesus say something similar for ourselves? Doesn't he say there, these things I've spoken to you, that in me you may have peace, in the world you have tribulation? That's true. He doesn't deny that, nor does he apologize for that, but he says, take courage. I have overcome the world. Therefore, be strong and courageous, because you are allying yourself with someone who has overcome something far greater than just a Canaanite army. You're aligning yourself, partnering yourself with someone who's overcome Satan and death itself. Just think about the power that it takes to do that. If there was ever a time when the world needed strong and courageous men of God, it is certainly today, in our homes, in our congregations, in our societies. But you can't circumvent, you can't skip steps, you can't ignore the rest of the message that God gave to Joshua, and that is to be careful to do all that I tell you. This is where we lose a lot of guys right here. They're like, yeah, I'll be strong and I'll be courageous. And then they go out failing to hear the rest of the instruction here. And that is that you need to apply yourself to the teaching of God and let this message not just get into your head as information, but to filtrate through all of your being and to become who you are. This message needs to be your thinking. This message needs to be your guide. This message needs to internalize to the point where you're thinking from a godly perspective rather than from a worldly one or a selfish one. So we lose a lot of well-intentioned men not because of lack of desire, but because of lack of training, lack of effort, lack of endurance. That's where we lose so many men. And if we just had more training and more effort and more endurance, then we wouldn't be losing so many men along the way. Men are not born men of God. They are born males. And they are made into men of God through the Spirit of God and kept there by their own conscious devotion to that Spirit's leadership. I know I see some congregations wanting to baptize their boys who are not even old enough to make man-like decisions there, and then try to make them into men by putting them into men's roles, like in the congregation. It's just amazing to me to see that. We would never let a woman, for example, do some of the things that we allow boys to do, because, you know, women would be usurping authority, but we seem to have no problem with a young boy usurping our authority in the same way. So it's just interesting to me to see how some congregations look at this, and they think that they're making their young boys into men by throwing them into responsibilities that they're not even trained for, not prepared for, not mature enough to take up in the first place. That's not how you make men, and that's not how you make men of God. That's not how men of God are made, we could say. Men cannot make boys into men of God. Men cannot make other men into men of God. The one that can make you into a man of God, really, there's two parties involved. First of all, there's you, and then there's God. The man of God is made when he obeys the word of God and becomes a Christian. And now also he sanctifies as Christ, Jesus Christ, as Lord in his heart, 1 Peter 3:15. And also when he follows Jesus wherever he goes, even to his own hurt. And also when he doesn't let anything in this world, not his family, not his spouse, not his children, not his friends, not his job, not his employer, not his peers, not even himself. Nothing in this world is going to deter him from his commitment to his God. That's how a man of God is made. Notice there are two parties involved there initially, and that is, of course, is God as the point of reference, and then there is the man who submits himself to God. Many men have been baptized, but not all have chosen the course that I just described. Some have recanted their faith. Some have become content to be weak and disconnect and be ineffective there, or they've allowed other men or women or children to sidetrack them, or just sadly what we're seeing more and more of is just indifference and apathy, becoming lazy and undisciplined. But those who take this seriously, do what is necessary to honor God and so on, their lives will not falter. They become men of God, not because they're such great men as the world sees them, but because they are aligning themselves once again with the great master, Jesus Christ. I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 16 with me. There's a passage here that we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at. It's just such a great, succinct, to-the-point passage here. And I know Paul is not talking specific to males when he says this. In other words, I think he's talking generally to the group, but he does refer to men specifically in the midst of all that. Okay, he says simply, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong, let all you do be done in love. And I think this is a great place for us to look at in a very general way of what is it that a man of God is. Well, he is, first of all, a man who is on the alert. You say, on the alert for what? Well, guarding the responsibilities that are given to him by God. First of all, his own soul. And then secondly, his household. And thirdly, the faith. And then fourthly, the congregation that he belongs to. Those are sobering responsibilities that are daunting challenges. I understand that, but he has a responsibility to be on the alert for those things. The world is not being on the alert for anything right now except its own self-interest. You know that. I don't have to preach on that because you already know it. And yet men of God have a different view of different responsibility, a different perspective. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 5 through 6, you are all sons of light, sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do. Let us be alert and sober. Sober in that context literally means serious-minded. Let us be serious-minded about what it is that we are doing here. The secular world is not on the alert, therefore it is heading for disaster. Roy and I were talking about this and in the social media class that we were having there, and he sent me some links to some videos of people, the traffic cameras, the intersection cameras, are catching people who are watching, looking down on their cell phones and walking right off the curb, right into traffic. Right into moving traffic. They're so engrossed in what they're looking at, scrolling or texting or doing something like that, they walk right into a car or a bus. And you see these videos of these people. They're standing there, and the next thing, this giant vehicle just mows right over them, and they're gone. You think, what happened there? Well, they weren't paying attention. And there's a real deep message there that should be imprinted on our brain when we hear about stuff like that. You know, if they had paid attention, then they could have saved their lives. I want you to think about that. We have all this increase of pedestrian deaths simply because, and it is on the rise enormously, simply because people are paying attention to the wrong things. It's not that they're being aimlessly wandering, you know, looking up at nothing here, you know, like this. We have those too, but especially in Kent. But my point here is that they're actually paying attention to all the wrong things when they should be paying attention to the danger at hand. They actually call these people pedestrians now. There's a name for that. Men of God can't afford to be that distracted. We need to be paying attention. There's just kind of a harrowing parable in all of this that we're talking about. People looking down at this world, paying attention to the things of this world, when what's coming up on them is their eternity. And they're not paying attention to that. And we have so many people that, in one way or the other, are stepping off the curb of this life and right into eternity, and it just takes them out. And they're not ready. It could have been. They're just not ready because, well, they were paying attention to something less than that. Pay attention. Be vigilant. Be on the alert. Be sober-minded. Be serious-minded. You have to be if you're going to be a man of God. The world needs it. More importantly, your congregation needs it. Even more importantly, your family needs it. And yes, you need that as well. 2 Corinthians 2, verse 11 says, in order, Paul is talking about, you know, our preparation here, forgiving one another, in order that no advantage being taken of us by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his schemes. The man of God cannot afford to be ignorant of Satan's schemes. because Satan wants us to be neutralized. He wants us men to be hamstrung. He doesn't care if you go to church. He doesn't care if you say your prayers. He doesn't care if you eat the Lord's Supper and listen to sermons and are generally a good person, as long as you're not effective as a man and a leader in whatever responsibility God has placed you. As long as you're not effective, you are hamstrung. And everyone knows, I hope, what a hamstrung horse can do. Pretty much nothing. It's a useless animal. Strong as it once was, capable of it could have been, being hamstrung renders it useless. And men of God, when they are hamstrung, no longer are serving or can serve as men of God in that condition. Stand firm in the faith, Paul goes on to say. Well, that seems obvious enough, but I want to stress the word firm here. Not just standing around, not just standing next to Christians, or not just standing up when the song leader says, let's rise for this song, right? But really driving pillars of conviction deep into our faith. When we lived in Alaska, we were not very far from a freeway in which they were building an overpass, and so we heard the giant thump, thump, thump as they're driving the pylons deep into the ground, 30 feet deep for the overpass that they were building there. And I kept thinking about that as I would pass by there or hear that, you know, that they're having to drive these things down deep because you don't want to be driving on an overpass that's kind of wobbly, right? So you want to have some structure, some stability to that. But in order to get structure and stability, what do you got to do? You have to go down deep. That's the way it is. Okay, foundation is extremely important to stability and structure. What is our society doing today? It's not going down deep. We're staying as surface and superficial and uncommitted as possible. And then we think that we're intelligent, wise, and knowledgeable people. Someone has said, yes, on Facebook, I saw it there, okay, that we are drowning in information and starving for wisdom. Think about that. We're drowning in information. We've got so much information we don't know what to do with, literally. But we don't have a whole lot of wisdom, not a whole lot of depth at all. You think about the Space Needle, one of Seattle's most visible geographical features there, or cityscape features there. Someone says, and I've asked this question too, why doesn't that thing fall over? You know, the Space Needle has survived several earthquakes, tremors, 90-mile-an-hour winds, and it has not budged one bit. The reason for that is because its foundation is deep underground. Its center of gravity is actually at ground level, not above, but at ground level. There is as much weight in the foundation that is underground as there is in the Space Needle above ground. Did a little research on that, just for you. Think about that. There's as much weight, much mass underground as there is above the ground. That's why when the wind slams against it, you think, boom, you know, that's what I would do if a 90-mile-an-hour wind hit me, right? But the Space Needle just stands there because it is so tethered, it is so well stabilized by its low center of gravity. I want you to just think about some of these things that we're talking about. Think about a man's center of gravity. Men, I'm not talking about your waistlines here. We're talking morally, spiritually, okay? If you're walking on the earth like every other man, then you have no advantage over every other man. You're just like them. And when those winds come, the storms come, the trials come, all the struggles come, you're going to fall over because you're no different than every other man out there. Because you have no depth, you have no strength, you have no stability, you have no deep entrenched foundation there. But if you do have that foundation, if you do have that depth, well, then you're going to be a different kind of man, and you're going to have a different kind of ending to all of that story there, right? And things are going to go well for you. The Psalm chapter 1 captures it exactly. Psalm chapter 1, starting in verse 1 here, is an excellent place to go to. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. And as a result of that, remember what God told Joshua, don't depart from what I told you. As a result of that, it says, he will be like a tree firmly planted by the streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, its leaf does not wither, and whatever he does, he prospers. Why are the trees so able to stand there in that case? Well, because they're well watered, they're planted in the right place, and because they have a good foundation. Any man has the ability to become a Christian, and any Christian man has the ability to be that kind of man. Think about that. course, Paul also says that we need to act like men, literally act manly, not like children, not effeminate, not like a bunch of clowns like we see sometimes in some of our Seattle parades here. I think you know what I'm referring to there. We are supposed to act like Jesus Christ would expect us to act and how he needs us to act, which means that we're not going to get all defensive when we're questioned about who we are and what we're doing. We're not going to get all frightened and run away when we are challenged, nor are we going to act irresponsibly when we need to be depended upon. But we're going to rise up to meet God's call for excellency, virtue, and integrity. We're going to stand firm and say, yes, I will, not like, oh, I'm open to that. I guess I'm willing to do that. Remember our lesson a couple weeks ago? We talked about that. When you say simply, I'm open to that, or I'm willing to do that, that's not the same as, yes, I will, I'm going to do that. One is an evasion of responsibility. The other one is a commitment to responsibility. Which kind of man are you? You might want to ask yourself. That's something every marriage and family needs, is a man of excellency, virtue, and integrity. The man of God's hero is Jesus Christ. And because of that, he has high moral standards. He has distinct goals. He has a character of steel, but he has a heart of velvet. He knows what he needs to do, and he's not afraid to do it. Because he knows God is with him, and God will make it happen if he gives his heart over to him. And then we also need to be strong. And it has nothing to do, again, with physique or physical strength, but better than that, strong in zeal, strong in resolve, strong in faith, strong in convictions. And the source of that strength comes really through three critical sources, really from God himself. And I don't mean just praying to God, but in his word and prayer and all of that, whatever it takes that God supplies, okay? Ephesians 6:10 sums it up here. Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Too many men forego prayer and study, and you can't replace that or duplicate that with anything else. Too many men think that going to church is sufficient, but you can't replace study and prayer with going to church. Too many men think that they studied the Bible once and they got it in their head and that's good enough. Too many men think that they're self-sufficient and self-supportive and self-reliant. Too many men think that they don't need what we have to offer here. They could just go out there and be their own kind of man of God on their own terms. Too many men are ignoring what God actually says it takes to become a man of God. And that is why too many men are not men of God. We also need each other. We need other Christians and specifically other men. I heard a great analogy to this here a couple weeks ago. A bunch of preachers and elders in this area got together talking about the need for preacher training and so on. But in the midst of that, the preacher from Kirkland got up there, and Brent Hunter, he got up there and was talking about an illustration about redwood trees. Everyone knows redwood trees are the largest living organism on earth. They're huge. I mean, not only in circumference, but also in height. They grow to, some 300 feet tall. And you think, what keeps something like that up? And he says, what's interesting is the taproot isn't actually as deep as you might think for some other trees, proportionately, that is, proportionate to their size. They do have a taproot or a root system, but what's really interesting about redwood trees is that they reach out to other redwood trees' root systems, and they all grab hold of each other, and they all latch on. So basically, it's like if you take on one redwood tree, you take on the whole family of redwood trees, right? Sorry, I had to get into the kind of mafia thing there, but, it does seem like that, right? I mean, you take on me, you take on the whole family, right? But there's a lot of truth to that. So when the winds and storms and everything come against a single tree, well, really, there is no single tree. You don't see redwoods growing by themselves. You only see them growing in groups, forests. Just think about that. You're not going to see individual Christians growing by themselves, but you will see them growing and flourishing when they start connecting with other Christians, because that is a source of strength. It's a powerful lesson, once again, drawn from nature, as God gave us nature to draw from in the first place. All these interwoven roots provide a great amount of strength and stability. Of course, there's also one's personal convictions, his own beliefs that demand action. That's what conviction is. It's a belief that is so strong it demands action. We're not talking about mere intellectual agreement to something like, yes, I do believe intellectually, academically, that Jesus Christ is the Lord. It's not like that. What we're talking about in a conviction is taking that belief, to the next step and saying, since I believe that Jesus Christ is Lord, this is what I'm going to do about it. That's what that means. That's a conviction. It's not just an agreement. It's a firm resolution based on what you agree to. Philippians 4:13, a lot of people like to quote that. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. But what people mean by that more often than not is anything I choose to do, God's going to give me the strength to do it. That's not what that passage means. That's not what that passage says. What the passage means and what it says in the context is anything God gives you to do, he's going to give you the strength to carry it out. You're not the one sitting there choosing your own ministry. You're not the one telling God how you're going to glorify him and how you're going to worship him. He's handing you responsibilities that says, not only am I giving you this charge here, but I'm also going to give you the strength and the necessities to carry out that charge. I'm going to equip you with the ability to carry out this charge that I'm handing you. That's what the passage says. I wish people would quote it rightly and use it in its context, but sadly the world just gloms onto it, says, yeah, in the me generation style, anything I want to do, God is going to endorse that, rubber stamp that seal of approval, and he's going to give me the, it just doesn't work that way. It's just not what it says, and it's not what it means. And then he says, let all that you do be done in love, because Christian love, godly love, tempers and dictates our attitude toward all relationships. Not the world's version of love, not your version of love, not anyone else's version of love, but godly love as expressed through God himself. God does not have versions of love. Doesn't have versions. He just has love. And when it says in 1 John 4:8 that God is love, there's only one kind of love that God exhibits, and that is the best kind, the kind that really is defined by his own divine nature, the kind that is sacrificial in nature, but always acts in the person's best interest who is the object of that love. And that's what we're supposed to exhibit and extend toward others. Love is not a feeling, and it's not an emotion, it's not a sentiment. It's not something you give only when it's convenient or comfortable or fits your schedule. It's not something to make you feel good. It's something that you give to others as a gift. It's a decision to treat others as God has treated you, and therefore it demands action and responsibility and sacrifice and conformity to Jesus Christ, because that's all of what God gives to you. The fact is, showing love may not make you feel good. Showing love in that way may be the most painful thing you have to do. I see so many parents in the world and even in the churches claiming to love their children but not denying their children any form of happiness. Whatever my children want, I need to, you know, go buy it, glom onto it, and give it to them and shower them with all this affection and everything. We have not only hovering helicopter parents, now we have bulldozer parents that are paving the way, you know, cutting down the grass and the, you know, the trees and just, you know, paving the way for their children so their children can walk serenely and peaceably and in full happiness. It's like you're not doing your children any favors there. Really, what's happening in those cases is that the parents are avoiding their own pain. They're claiming that they're doing it for the children, but really they don't want to suffer, as they see it, by seeing their children go through difficulties. And then secondly, they're not acting in their children's best interest, because how in the world are you preparing your children for with this thing called reality? So when they get out of the house, it's reality. It's going to slap them like a wet towel in the face. Everyone's not going to care about what you thought about your children. Reality has a way of waking everyone up. So parents claim to be loving their children in that way. That's really not love. You know that tough love is still love. It's still love, even if it's tough. Christian love is the best kind of love. Godly love does no harm, does no wrong. Romans 13, verse 10. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5, we're told to diligently add moral excellence to our faith. In the classical Greek, that moral excellence really means manliness, vigor, courage, valor, fortitude. In essence, it is choosing to do what is right simply because it's right, without worrying about or taking into account the consequences of that action. Christian virtue, godly energy, is really what we're talking about. It's the same word you see in 1 Peter 2:9. It's that same word from which excellencies is derived. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the moral excellencies, really, of God, the virtue of God, the fortitude of God, the fortitude of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. We achieve moral excellence by making important to us what is important to Jesus. This works for women too, by the way. We're not just talking to men here, but we're just simply addressing men, but not only talking about men here. So you ask yourself, what was morally excellent to Jesus? Well, doing his Father's will was a morally excellent pursuit of Jesus. It's not an afterthought. It was an all-consuming endeavor. He literally lived for God. He says in John 5:17, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. What a great attitude to have. My God is working, and I'm working too. We're not working equally in the fact that, you know, I'm like God, and when I say that, but remember, God does his part, and I'm doing my part. God's grace, my faith, working together toward my salvation. We both have the same objective in mind, me being saved, or you being saved, or us being saved. Salvation is what it's all about. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 1 and 2, Peter says, in essence, just as Christ literally died, suffered in the flesh, so we have died. We died when we united with him. Therefore, let's not go on presenting ourselves as servants to the world, but rather serve the will of God. Let's serve the will of God instead, since we have died to the world and died with Christ in that commitment. You can't pursue moral excellence until you come to terms with refusing to let go of what you used to serve. And then it takes personal discipline to do this. This is a learned behavior, which means it's going to take effort and be measured over time, but it is doable. This is what scares so many people. They're like, oh, if you could just give me a single Bible verse or maybe a magic pill or maybe a sermon or, you know, a little website I could check out, then I could be morally excellent. It's like, you don't get it, because it's going to take time and it's going to take effort, your effort. And you're going to make mistakes along the way. That's part of the process. But it is a good thing to do, and it is doable. Jesus was also very concerned about considered morally excellent his ambition to take care of other people. He never let his own personal concerns obscure or override his godly love for his fellow man. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, right? Mark chapter 10, verse 45, always on the forefront of Jesus' mind. Romans 12, verse 10, Paul says, be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. It takes a man or a woman of God to do that, because that's not natural to us. It's a learned behavior as well. And not just learn to love Christians and your family. That's the easy part, honestly, compared to loving your enemies and those who hate you. I think we're going to be seeing more of that as we go forward. More enemies, more people that hate you, okay? In the past, they all kind of, you know, were in the distant, on the horizon there. But I think you're going to see them more and more in your face. And you're going to have to learn ahead of time how to deal with those people in Christian love. Love your enemies. Do good to them. And your reward will be great. And you'll be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Luke 6, verse 35. Then there's a measure of personal purity and holiness, right? I mean, that was important to Jesus. That was a point of moral excellence. Not talking about being soft and wimpy and cowardly and effeminate, but rather purity of heart, purity of mind, purity of love. This is a tough sell in a society that really prides itself on being sacrilegious, on being vulgar, on being crude, and so on. Many comedies that are passing for comedies today are just raunchy, profanity-laced parodies of one thing or another, usually pointedly at, not surprisingly, Christians and Christianity. It seems like people want to purposely take God and drag him through the mud. Comedians really race to see who can be the crudest and rudest in their stand-up routines. What is the most offensive to Christians, to Christianity, and God? So anyone can be rude and vulgar and offensive and impure and unholy. Anyone can do that. But those people are not going to inherit eternal life who choose to be that way. They're not going to be with God in the end. 1 John chapter 3, verse 1 through 3. If you read that passage there, I'll give you time to read that on your own, and I invite you to do so. John says, in essence, see how we are called children of God, and indeed we are. But he also goes on to say that we have set our mind on Christ, and anyone who sets his mind on Christ also chooses to be pure as he is pure. Chooses to be pure. Decides himself to be pure. Again, a tough call in an ungodly, impure society. But if we are to purify ourselves, and or be men of God, I should say, then we are going to have to purify ourselves. Of course, self-denial was also very important to Jesus. We know in Philippians 2, verse 7 and 8, that he emptied himself and humbled himself. He denied himself, which really means that he chose to put aside his self-interest for the sake of his Father's will and our salvation. I don't know what that means in its entirety, because I don't understand what it means for a divine being to empty himself, because I'm not a divine being. But I do know this, that whatever he did in that passage, or whatever that passage is explaining in what he did, I know this, that he set aside his self-interest in order to take care of me. And that's pretty powerful when you look at that. In order to take care of you, and to take care of me, and to take care of us and our salvation, and to fulfill God's will for him. It is something for which we owe our eternal gratitude. Here's a point I want to make that is really powerful, more powerful than I'm giving it time for here. But obedience is more than law-keeping. It is also a reverent disposition of one's heart to God. What I mean by that is simply this, that a lot of people are like the Pharisees. They're very technical in their legal requirements. Well, I came to church, you know, I literally prayed the prayer, I literally read the passage, and, you know, and I'm very literal and technical and law-keeping and legalistic about that. But you know, obedience to God, even though those things may be necessary, obedience to God isn't just taking care of the technical requirements. It's also a disposition of your heart toward God. You can take care of all the technical requirements and be just as irreverent and unfaithful in your heart as any other ungodly man. But you took care of all the details, but you missed the point. Isn't that really what Jesus said to the people in the Sermon on the Mount? Yeah, you guys are taking all the details and holding those up as being all that's important. He says, but here's what you missed. You've heard it said, but I say unto you. So think about that. That is very important. Self-denial means the same for you and I as it did for Christ, to put aside our interests, serve the Father's will instead. Don't be conformed to this world. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Everyone loves to quote the verse, but they're not necessarily willing to do what it takes to achieve that. Well, we looked at Joshua and we looked at David. We have a better understanding, more resources and greater knowledge than those men ever had. We have Jesus Christ, and yet it doesn't mean that we're automatically going to be men of God. Men of God love Jesus. He is their role model. He is their teacher, their leader, their warrior. He wants us to succeed, but in doing so, he needs us to follow him. Paul said, imitate me as I have also imitated Christ. That should be every man and woman of God's desire right there, is to fulfill that objective for themselves. Be an imitator of me. Why? Because I'm already imitating Christ. Don't be a man follower, but do follow those who are following Christ. Something we ought to be able to say, especially after years of proven experience. And here's something I want to address just briefly. Some of you might be looking at all this and saying, yeah, but first of all, it's just too late. I'm too old. There's too much damage done. I'm in too deep, whatever. These are words of defeat, not words of victory. These are words of unbelief, not words of conviction, because it's not too late. God's grace and God's forgiveness can overcome any sin, and his power can lift you out of any difficulty. I'm not saying he's going to take away all your problems. What I'm saying is he will give you the courage and the strength to go through any problems that need to be gone through in order to get to where you need to go. That's what he does. Doesn't necessarily stop the storm, but he does provide a way for you to endure it and in a way that is successful. Others are saying, well, that's all good information, but not today. Well, more words of defeat, because procrastination is not moral excellence, but is one of Satan's schemes. Remember, we're supposed to be smarter than that. Satan loves for us to procrastinate, loves for us to put off what is important, loves for us to say, maybe tomorrow. Others are saying, well, it's just too hard. I'm not that kind of man. More words of defeat here. It is hard, of course, but it's not too hard. Excellent things are the most difficult things to acquire. But remember that God promises to help. Other Christians are willing to help. Quite frankly, I'm willing to help. If you think that I'm capable of helping you, if we're able to communicate and talk as friends, and you want to sit down with me and I can help you, if you think I'm able to do so, and if you don't think I'm able to do so, then find someone who is. There's other Christians out there who are willing to talk with you and help you. The bottom line is that nothing in the world can stop any man from being a man of God except one thing, and you all know what it is. It's that man himself. That's the only thing that can stop you from being a man of God. So I'm asking you through this series, through this lesson, to listen to good advice. Listen to wise counsel. Don't accept that satanic reasoning. God loves you. God cares about you. God is willing to forgive you. But understand this, that God is also, in giving you free will, allowing you to perish if you so choose by resisting him and resisting his word. We have a God that wants to save you from perishing. But we also have a God that will allow you to perish if that's what you really want. Think about that. What kind of God does that? We want you to think about the choices that you're making today, the choices that you're continuing to make on a daily basis, and the choice that you've made about God himself. It's your choice, not someone else's. Always has been, always will be. That's my lesson. I hope that it has helped you. If you need to respond by coming forward, maybe you're ready to become a Christian this morning, or maybe you just need to rededicate yourself to God. If you need to do so by coming forward, this will be your time to respond. Come forward if you need to, as we stand for this song.